Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. Let's call it a rain delay. You know, they have that at the ballpark, and they don't have it for some events, but I sure remember growing up when I liked baseball. I don't pay much attention now, but I used to. So we're on a few minutes late, but we've got the whole hour, and thank heavens we're on, because I have a marvelous guest, and I'm just delighted to have him on his newest book. And what a book, considering all that's going on right now. I'm talking about Michael Parenti. And Michael is an internationally known political scientist. He's an award-winning author and lecturer. He's also one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts, social critics, and anti-war activists. Oh, he's written so many books. I've only missed about one or two of them. I've literally got a shelf stacked with Michael's books, and they include Democracy for the Few, now in its umpteenth division. I lost count, 8, 9, 10, whatever it is.
Ninth,
Michael?
Right. Yes.
Oh, I could only dream of having a book that would have half that many editions. Even just a few would be wonderful. But also Super Imperialism, Inventing Reality about the State of the Media, and I think that book was the first media critique ever written in book form. And your newest, Michael, The Face of Imperialism. Can I just read on page 7 how you define imperialism, and let you take over and get into this very important topic? You say, quote, imperialism is defined as follows: the process whereby the dominant investor interests in one country bring to bear military and financial power upon another country in order to expropriate the land, labor, capital, natural resources, commerce, and markets of that country. In short, empires do not just pursue power for power's sake. There are real material interests at stake, fortunes to be made many times over, and you go on, oh, indeed so, and that really is what's going on in all of America's imperial wars now. But, Michael, I welcome you, and what a timely book this is.
Oh, good. I'm glad you think so. I think the book can help you understand what's happening in these various countries and helps you to understand that U.S. foreign policy is very consistent, very rational, very successful in doing what it wants to do. There are certain kinds of dictators whom they support, they love, they make excuses about. When Joe Biden was asked if Mubarak of Egypt was a dictator, he said, no, he's a friend of ours. He's been worked very well with us. No, he's not a dictator. And Hillary Clinton said, oh, Mubarak, he brings stability. He's a good ally. So they didn't see him as a dictator, even though he had 30 years of oppression and deprivation imposed on the Egyptian people. He let the IMF in. He let Western investors in. He played along with Israel. He was their kind of dictator. But then Gaddafi came along, and Gaddafi did other things. He expropriated the oil industry in Libya, kicked out the private oil companies. He used the earnings from oil to build free schools and free housing and subsidize food allotments for people. And that's what they hated about Gaddafi, and they still do. They're going to undo him and destroy his country, as they are doing it with the bombing and such. So for someone to then say U.S. policy is inconsistent, what's our interest involved here? It's confused. No, you're confused. You don't see the consistency. Those dictators who play along, open up their country to the IMF and the World Bank, open up their country to the oil companies or corporations to take their resources, those dictators are called friends of the West and such and the like, and they are given aid and their police forces are built up and so forth. Those, you know, on the other hand, those leaders, be they dictators or democratically elected or whatever else, but those who use any of their resources for their own self-development and self-definition and such, those are the dictators who are called worse than Hitler and are seen as dangerous, as a threat to us and the like, and they're demonized. And once you demonize a certain leader, then you have license to bomb his people. And that's what's happened again and again. And the American people are taken in every time, and even some of our progressive intellectuals are taken in. They end up standing shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the Pentagon and the mainstream media, who they say you should never believe the mainstream media, and yet they believe them on these issues. And they stand there and they denounce Milosevic and Noriega and Gaddafi and these people. So what my book tries to do is try to get people, to unconfuse people and show them how U.S. policy is transparently clear and consistent.
Oh, indeed so, Michael. And even Democrats like Hugo Chavez, when they try to do socially beneficial things, they get called Hitler. I mean, I simply can't imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine calling anybody today Hitler. I mean,
right.
There's simply no comparison.
Elected. That's right. Democratically elected leaders get the same thing. Chavez in Venezuela, Aristide in Haiti,
twice indeed.
Democratically elected and yet kicked out, and Bill Clinton kicking him out, double-crossing him and such. And Bush, of course, double-crossing him, bringing him back into power with the understanding that he does not do anything to change the situation. And what happens in countries like Haiti? Those were rich, beautiful, prosperous countries where the people lived, were rich agriculture. They all had pretty much enough to eat at one time centuries ago. And today it's destitution. It's been plundered. Their rice agriculture has been undermined. Every industry in Haiti has just about been done in, and the country's been taken over by the corporations and such, and the people are made poorer and poorer. And another people who pay the price for this imperialism are the American people too. We have ponied up tens of trillions of dollars just in the last half century to build and maintain these thousands of military bases and interventions all around the world. So we have money right now. We have money to fight four wars, or four, five, six, if you want to count every bombing everywhere, and maintain all of this, all these regimes and such. We have money for that, but we don't have money for schools and bridges and tunnels and jobs and industry and the like. So there's a third worldization of everywhere, including the United States itself, which is to leave the people poor and hungry. The poorer and hungrier I can make you, the harder you will work for less and less. You'll line up for a job for 20, 30 cents an hour, like they do in Indonesia or other countries, because that's the only work around. So we have a rollback going on right now, the third worldization of America, the third worldization of other places. And that means stripping back the human services, increasing military spending every year. Every year the military budget gets bigger, whether it's a George Bush or a Barack Obama. That budget keeps increasing. The national security state keeps growing. And that's what imperialism is about. Make the world safe for the Fortune 500.
Oh, you bet your life. Oh, I mean, there's so many comments I could add, Michael. It really is a very, very shameless, disgusting, appalling story. And right now, I don't know about, certainly not today, but we've had for weeks, I guess maybe even months, a debate in Washington about the need to rein in the deficit, and we need to, a program of austerity and budget cuts. But the topic of reining in the out-of-control military budget, that's a far greater budget than just the headline $700-plus billion. You've got so much more added on to that, the intelligence, the supplementals, the interest on the national debt. I mean, it just goes on and on, well over $1 trillion.
Right.
And there's never a word about the fact that we spend as much or more than the rest of the world combined. And the only enemies we have are the ones that we make ourselves. I mean, no leader of a country anywhere in his or her right mind would have a dream of attacking this country, including China, including Russia, any of them. And yet we just rampage the world, plundering and expropriating and killing. I mean, this just goes on and on and on endlessly, piling on more billions of dollars every single year. Whatever the Pentagon wants, the Pentagon gets, and the war profiteers get, and the people get, what do the people get? The people get, you know what, Michael, and they're getting less of it all. Well, they're getting more and more of, shall we just call it, the shaft, and less more of what government should be doing for them.
Yeah, it does seem to be the case that imperialism really means the impoverishment of most of the working people of the world and the enrichment of a very small straight on at the very, very top, and it's working very well. And the way they get the American people to go along is by playing two things. One is to stoke their messianic pride and say we are the greatest country and we are called upon to be a superpower and do this and do that. But even more important is to play upon their fears. Surprisingly, despite all the persistent propaganda that the American people are fed, surprisingly high numbers are hesitant or reluctant to engage in wars. The Gulf War, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush Sr., that was the American public was about 75% to 80% against going into engaging in a war with Iraq, about Kuwait, saying, what, where? They don't even know where some of these places are, can't even find them on the map. So the trick then is to play upon their fears. And once you frighten people enough, once you convince them that their hearth and home are at stake, their jobs or the oil that they'll need for their cars and their and to heat their homes, and they won't be able to get it, and which was just the opposite of what the Gulf was about. The Gulf was about Saddam Hussein wanting a larger oil quota to sell more oil to us, you know, and old man Bush worrying about oil prices getting falling because of a glut. That they never told that to the American people. They just said he controls our oil and he's worse than Hitler. And this is a guy who was, in fact, a murderer and a torturer, but who the U.S. supported, the CIA created and brought him forth. But once you convince the people that their security is at stake, then they will hand over billions to you in budget to fight another war, and they will hand over their rights and their freedoms even. They'll go along with what you want to do.
Michael, you know the famous quote going back to the Nazi era from Hermann Göring that he supposedly told to a prison a psychologist before he took his own life, that the psychologist asked him, how did you ever convince the German people to go to war? And his answer was more or less, they never. Ordinary people don't want to go to war, you know. I mean, farmers want to stay in their fields, and others want to, you know, just to live their normal lives. So, in essence, I mean, you got to scare the hell out of them.
Right.
the Russians are coming or whatever. I mean, you scare them that this terrible enemy, that unless we act, I mean, they're going to come here and they're going to destroy us. And you keep repeating this big lie until people believe it, and then you can get them to go along with anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly it. Well, any other question? Or?
Oh, I just want to—I want to get your comments on the things that you address in the book. And again, I mean, this is such a key issue.
Let me say one thing. The nature of empire is, and I say this in the book, the nature of empire is to define every country as either a vassal, that is a country that will act like the client state and cooperate with the U.S. and fit in and go along with policy and subsume its own interests under those of the U.S., also known as allies. But either it's a vassal, a satellite, and that sort of thing, or a potential enemy or potential enemy. If you're not a satellite, if you are not attached, you're not within the U.S. orbit, you are a potential enemy or a regional enemy, seen as a regional power. That was the charge made about Iraq. Because even if Iraq was an enemy, it's a little country of, what was it, 40 million people, 30 million people. Well, you say, well, but it's a regional power. That is, it will gather under its wing other countries, and then there'll be a whole region here, a whole area that will be a threat to us and like. And that term was used again and again. It's interesting. And now it's being used against Iran. Iran was a regional power. It might emerge into being a regional power. And the bigger countries like India and Russia and China, of course, these are scare words. China is a scare word. Barack Obama, in his State of the Union address, he's talking about, we are going to be competitive with China, and we get our education going and all this. What is this need to be in competition? What is this need to define another country as a rival who we have to measure up against and go against, you know? But that is the mentality of empire, and that's the material imperative of empire, because your goal is to control everything. You must control the markets, the resources, the capital, and the labor of these other countries. And any country that you can't control is a country that potentially presents an alternative model of how things can be done. It's a country that can be served. It's called the power of the good example, and it has to be destroyed. This good example to others, it has nothing to do just with oil or just with this or that. When Ronald Reagan invaded Grenada, it wasn't for the nutmeg, as he pointed out. It's not the nutmeg. You can get perfectly good nutmeg in Africa if you want. It was to serve notice to every other country in the Caribbean that if you take this course, this is what's going to happen to you. And the U.S. sent troops into Grenada, a country, an island country of 102,000 people. This wasn't a threat to the security of America, but it was presented as that this was a threat to us, that they would play along with the Soviets and build Soviet submarine bases and this and that, and they're right at the choke point of our merchant shipping routes and all sorts of fabricated crazy stories. And once they got back in Grenada, they destroyed the revolutionary movement that was going on. They got rid of the communal farms. They turned the communal farmlands into golf courses for rich tourists to come back to. The unemployment rate zoomed up to about 30% from near zero. Of course, the New Jewel movement in Grenada was was providing a job program, something we sorely need in America and we don't have, and this administration is not doing. So that's the point. I take the case of Grenada because there's no great amounts of oil in Grenada. There's no great resources. There's no great threat in terms of its size. And yet they went in and attacked it. It's to stamp out any ember, any country, no matter how big or small, to stamp it out if it chooses to chart an independent course that is outside the global system of multinational corporate capitalism. Now, the one country that presents a problem to them is China. China is about the only country in the world that is not afraid of the United States. They have 1.5 billion people. They have about $1 trillion in IOU notes or in U.S. currency. They're outperforming the U.S. in terms of productivity and exports. They go into countries, instead of making enemies, they make friends with them. Instead of just stripping them with the IMF and with big oil companies and big corporations, they go in and say, what do you need? You want us to build some bridges? You want some roads? You want this? Okay. And you just give us those resources, and or we'll let us buy them from you, and so forth. They're doing very well. They're very popular in Africa, a continent that hates the U.S. because of what it's done. It's supported dictators like Mobutu and the like, and it's impoverished and stripped the continent and plundered the continent of Africa. And the Chinese aren't plunderers. You know, they trade for themselves, but they pursue mutual benefits with the country they're dealing with. Which is not to romanticize or make them, to say they're a hero nation of any sort. No, there are immense problems in China and such. But they are doing certain things. They're the only country in the world that has a population control policy. India doesn't. India soon will have a larger population than China, because in China, families are 1 and 2 children. In India, they're still 7, 8, 9, and the like. In China, the feudal class that just deprived people all were destroyed in the Chinese Communist Revolution. You had 40 years of education, infrastructure development, and the like. In India, that feudal class is still in power, and about 70% of the people live in the same abject poverty and utter misery that they did when Mahatma Gandhi was rallying them for peaceful change. So China is really on the road to going somewhere. They're building these super speed transcontinental train systems. Now Barack Obama wants to build the same thing here in the U.S. to match the Chinese. When what we need is really inner city improvements of mass transit and such, and we need a more rational transportation system. But this president we got is just a grandstander. He just pursues whatever's the next policy. That's the killing of Bin Laden is another example. The Grandstand Act.
Absolutely, Michael. I concur with you right down the line from Grenada to China. I'd add one thing in terms of countries that will not take any real guff from us, and that's Russia, the only country in the world that can match our nuclear arsenal, more or less. I mean, how many do you need? And delivery systems that just about work the same way.
And China also, I meant to mention that China has a retaliatory, can retaliate in any case, you know.
Oh, they can retaliate. They don't have the arsenal that we or Russia have.
They've got enough to make it too costly to do something like that.
Oh, indeed so. Indeed so. I mean, they're literally beating us at our own game. And as you say, China has lots of warts and lots of things to improve. It's certainly not a democracy, but China goes into regions of the world and they play ball cooperatively with nations. You know, we want to trade with you, we want your resources, but we'll do this, that, and the other thing. And we go in, and our idea of a free trade deal is we give the orders and you obey. and if you don't...
Well, our ideal is you open up your land, labor, and natural resources to the private corporations and our banks and such, and investors who come in on terms that are totally set by our people, by U.S. private interests. That's the idea. That's the government's idea of good relations with countries, pursuing our interests. We always hear references to, well, U.S. interests. That's the phrase that's used again and again. And in the book, I raise the question, what are U.S. interests, you know? And how do those U.S. interests, how do they relate to us in our interests and such? And the goal is to strip back any country that has any portion of its natural wealth in the public sector, used for social security purposes, for disability, for well-being, for education, for housing, for the needs of the people and all that. And someone will say, do you mean that the empire builders want to strip down all those things? And I point out they're called structural adjustment programs. They were even doing it to Libya, but not enough. You see, Gaddafi still had a lot of the old good stuff, still preserved it. The structural adjustment programs are ones in which the country agrees to cut back on its food subsidies, cut back on its housing subsidies, cut back on its social programs, and open up the country completely to private investors, and in this way they will get some loans, and in this way they can meet by consuming less and producing more and giving more over to the private companies. They will be able to keep up with the terrible debts that are imposed upon them. And you can say, well, would they do that to these countries? Well, it's very advantageous to the investors. What do you mean, would they do that? They're doing it right here in our own country. They're doing it right in the U.S. Now they've got Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid under attack, the last few things that are left. They've just pretty much about destroyed public housing in this country. They've pretty much destroyed jobs programs. You don't hear Obama talk about jobs at all. They've struck all programs to war against poverty. You don't hear Obama ever talk about the poor. He talks about the middle class and in very vague, fluffy terms. Their goal is to roll back everything. It's the third worldization of everywhere. It's not just the third worldization of America, but it's the third worldization of everywhere. They're trying to do the same thing to the Western European countries, and that's what the expansion of the European Union has been all through Eastern Europe now. It's to get cheap labor to move from east to west, and self-interested expropriation capital to move from west to east, to take over, privatize everything in the east, and have it taken over by private capital.
Michael, we're using the economic crisis that broke in late 2007 to do exactly what you're talking about, the idea that we have this problem in Europe. Let's just talk about Western Europe. Certainly it's affecting Eastern Europe too, but talk about Western Europe, the developed countries, and right here in the U.S. And again, I mean, the cry goes out that we need to cut back, impose austerity, but be very, very generous to the corporate interests, doesn't matter who they are, the bankers, the war profiteers, the big drug companies, the big insurance companies, right straight down the line. There's no austerity for them. It's only austerity for the people. And why people will buy that line, I simply have no idea. And then combined with the idea of terror threats and we need to be vigilant, and I expect you know, some of the comments after the alleged bin Laden killing that I have a different, much, much different view on. I've written a number of bin Laden articles, Michael. I have another one going out tomorrow on the tapes that were just released. Oh, well, that's a separate story. But some people have said, well, you know, now that we got rid of enemy number one, quote unquote, maybe we can draw down in Afghanistan and Iraq and so on. But I expect just the opposite to happen, and I think Hillary Clinton said it. Obama said something like the world can feel safer today, and Hillary followed up with a statement that we need to be more than ever vigilant. And I think that's the key statement. More than ever vigilant means that we can expect more attacks, vengeance maybe. So we have to not rev down, but rev up. to go after, find what these terror threats are, and make a greater than ever effort to go after them, which to me means more war.
The people who say it's a safer world because we got rid of this monster, Bin Laden, I totally bought into the mythology of it. I mean, they believe what they are fed, and then they can be fed A, and then they can be fed not A. As you just pointed out, you say great victory in the war against terrorism, and then Hillary comes out the next day and says, we've got to be even more vigilant, as you just pointed out. So, which means what? Which means, in other words, it doesn't matter he was killed. There's still this other problem we have. But that, and the problem really isn't terrorism. The problem is making the world safe for the Fortune 500 and conjuring up a threat of terrorism. The terrorism threat, you know, is about 20, 30 years old. I used to hear it back when Claire Sterling, and she was used to be hyped all over the place in the Washington Post and the New York Times and Parade Magazine. Everywhere. Claire Sterling used to expose the threat of terrorism, the international terrorism web throughout the world that was out to get us and kill us, with its headquarters in Moscow, in communist Moscow. And once the Soviet Union was overthrown and all those other communist countries were overthrown and their economies were everything was privatized and deregulated and everybody was poor and unemployment went from near zero up to 20-30%. Once all that happened, they had a problem. They said, who's the enemy now? How do we justify everything we're doing? And finally, that in short order, it became Islamic terrorism. So we got Claire Sterling all over again without Claire involved, and everybody talking about a global terrorism headed by Islamic extremists and a global network organization called Al-Qaeda, and that is out there to get us. Why haven't they had more attacks in America? I don't know. The food supply has zero security, as the Secretary of Agriculture under Clinton said. He lost his job for saying it. He's saying, boy, they could hit our food supply anytime they want. The water supplies and most communications, mass transit targets. And where is this Al-Qaeda? And was Bin Laden... I don't even think Bin Laden had anything to do with 9/11.
Oh, he didn't. He didn't.
I watched the film of him sitting there in his cave. He was being interviewed, and he was giggling about 9/11, saying, it's amazing. It's amazing. They brought both those buildings down. It was some young people, some young men in the West, situated in the West, who did it. And he did not sound like the guy who had put out the order on this job and who heads an organization that carefully did it. He was sort of clapping his hands. I mean, you know, killing 3,000 innocent people, you kind of want to pop him one right in the face. But the point is, I don't think he was the guy in charge. And then when the 9/11 commission was finally appointed over a year later by a very reluctant George Bush, when it was appointed, I remember that was the Keene Hamilton, you know, dog and pony show that investigated it. They had several people they were interviewing, and was on the radio, I remember, it was being broadcast at the time, asking each one of them in a row, right next in quick succession, was Bin Laden the head? He was in charge of 9/11. He was the guy who made it happen. Oh yes, he was, sir. That's right. Yes. And the next guy said, oh yes, no doubt about it. So I'm sitting there waiting to hear. Okay, it was Bin Laden. He didn't sound like it when I heard that interview of him. Okay, it was Bin Laden. What's the proof? I thought they would then go on and say, we have people in Al-Qaeda who this and that. We have, you know, Mohammed so-and-so who's had this link. We know that he connected with people. They didn't say anything. They didn't offer a shred of evidence or the slightest conjecture as to why we should think it was Osama bin Laden. I'm sure he's a high-visibility critic of the U.S. And then I read things that bin Laden said, and his his comments were all defensive, not offensive. It wasn't, we will get you because you're secular and you're prosperous and you're rich and you're successful and we hate that and we're jealous and we'll kill you. It wasn't, which is what the Western commentators were saying was motivated. He was saying things like, he was playing defense. He kept saying, if you leave us alone, we will leave you alone. The only thing we have is this retaliation as a way to try to stop you. Which was a poor strategy, of course, because all it did was provide fuel for the U.S. leaders to turn to their people and say, see what monsters they are. You see what we're facing. You see what we have to do. We have to get in there. We have to go and kill more of them. So
Michael,
be safe.
Obviously we lied about the whole thing, but David Ray Griffin, and he wrote about this, he wrote a book on bin Laden, but he wrote one or more articles as well, and he discovered three interviews after 9/11 that bin Laden gave to Al Jazeera, and mm-hmm. in each one he said very clearly, and I pulled quotes from David's from one of David's articles, mm-hmm. he said each time that he had no knowledge of and no involvement in 9/11, and yet 2 days on May 3rd, Al Jazeera misquoted him. They didn't even check their own interviews, misquoted him and said that he admitted involvement in 9/11. He had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it. By the way,
where did Griffin get the original denial of involvement?
Well, he quoted a source. He had a lot of his own information. Of course, he wrote a book about this, Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive. David will be on this program later in May, by the way, Michael, and we'll talk a little bit about that book and two that he wrote after that on all related to 9/11. We'll have a full hour talking with him about it. But
in any case, I don't want to go into 9/11 because there are unanswered questions on all sides. My position is the same as Ray McGovern, which is we need a real investigation and objective, but not by somebody appointed by the White House either to cover up again. But we need a real investigation of 9/11. There are unanswered questions by both sides, but the point is it's the government that's under an obligation to answer the questions. They're the ones that have the information and the like, and we can't seem to get them to look at this. Of course.
Yeah. It's the same with all the major events. You know, I mean, we need real facts on the table, not the stuff that they feed us. That really, it's simply one bald-faced lie following another one, another one, another one. And the media, as you know, and you've written about it, just keep regurgitating this stuff. And people turn on their television set thinking they're getting real news. Well, anyone listening to this program knows that you do not get real news when you turn on your TV set, unless you get the RT TV or Press TV. You certainly don't get it on the major U.S. networks. But this is where most people turn, and they think they're really getting the news, and it's repeated around the clock, and the people literally are believing things that absolutely aren't so.
It's very revealing when Hillary Clinton says we're losing the information war, and what she really means is we're losing our monopoly grip on the information flow. But to call it an information war, it's a war. I thought you put out information to inform people, not to control them in competition with some other perspective. I thought we were supposed to be able to look at a diverse outlets and arrays of perspectives and make our own decisions as a democratic citizenry should do. So what we have here is an admission that in fact this is a war, and we don't want RT, Russia Today. We don't want France 24, which is getting cracked down upon now by Sarkozy and such because of progressive critical perspective leaking in there. We don't want a Bolivarian network, you know. And Clinton, she was absolutely shrill when she said, and China is building a global news network in English, and she was saying like something horrible. Aren't we supposed to welcome alternative perspectives? And well, let's see what the Chinese have to say about the world and the like, no, this was seen as a danger, as a war that we're in, and the U.S. isn't losing. What they're losing a little bit is the absolute monopoly over information that they used to have. Like, let's take this: the American people have never even seen the Iraq War. The American people have never seen the death and the destruction and the misery and the desperation and the injury and the pain and the bloodletting that's in Iraq. Those pictures, that footage is constantly, constantly suppressed and censored. You tell me the last time you've seen a picture of three American soldiers lying there, or body parts of them lying there having just been blown up. You tell me when you have ever seen those pictures. They would never show those. Yugoslav war that Clinton waged against Yugoslavia, they showed that one picture of that bus being blown up on the bridge over the Danube. Ordinary peaceful Serbian people getting killed by an American bomb. U.S. support for the war dropped 20 points, and Clinton immediately went and bombed the Yugoslavian news center and killed about 30 or 40 people who were working late in the center. Kill those people to make the world safe from information that might move against the interests of the empire.
Oh, so true. That I remember the war so well, but you and I, Michael, are old enough to think back to a lot of old wars that young people today, maybe they read a little bit about it, certainly don't hear about it in school, except the wrong kinds of information, but I think we're pretty close to the same age. I was pretty young, but I have vague recollections of Franklin Roosevelt. And I certainly remember Harry Truman and everybody after that. And there has never been a good war. And even in the old days, we grew up before there was any television. But even in the old days, it was tough getting real information. But maybe it was a smidgen better than the way it is today. But you're right about the information war. And, of course, way back when, there was no Internet. And to me, I see that as the biggest threat they worry about, that more and more people have access online.
It was no better under Harry Truman. Under Harry Truman, we never got the stories about the torture and the brutal murder of Greek communists and Greek progressives who wanted changes, or what the Turkish gendarme did to Turkish people who wanted reforms and betterness and betterment. And how they were murdered and tortured and beaten.
I'm no fan of Harry Truman. Believe me, Michael. And he's the guy who, after the Japanese.
What I'm saying is, regardless of the personality and regardless of the time and the period, there's been this remarkable, striking consistency of keeping the people in the dark, keeping them frightened, and keeping America building up its coercive forces, its destructive forces, in order to keep these people in these various countries from trying to reclaim their own lives and their own resources and their own country and their own world. And this has been very consistent regardless of the personality or political power that's in office.
Well, I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. And it's been especially so leading up to World War II and everything that's happened after that. But, of course, you can go back. I mean, my God, you can go back to the 19th century. Go back to the very beginning where we just ravaged the country and destroyed native people so we could steal land from Atlantic to Pacific and half of Mexico and Cuba and other places from Spain and on to today.
Right, and that story was never told. I never learned that in my history classes, not in college even. It was never told that when the Puritan fathers came to America, Governor Winthrop and his Plymouth Colony and the like, the first thing they did was massacre the Pequot Indians. I never learned that. I just heard that there was a settlement, and they were looking for freedom of religion and such. They massacred the Pequot Indians, and the second thing they did was they went into real estate. Winthrop and Witherspoon and all these other Peabody, old New England names, even today are still patrician names in New England. they just claimed big chunks of land and they became owners of it, Plymouth Bay Colony and such. They went into business. They knew what they were doing, which is you kill the people, take their land, get rich. And that's been the formula ever since. But the remarkable thing is it's never taught, it's never discussed, and it's not recognized. So we do face a real false consciousness. And the gap between what U.S. leaders actually do in the world and what the U.S. public thinks they're doing, that gap is one of the great propaganda victories of history. It's persistent, and it continues to this moment right now.
Oh,
to the right to the moment where you get all those idiot alcohol-ridden college kids in front of the White House there on Pennsylvania Avenue shouting the other night, USA, USA, we got him, we killed him, we knocked him out, celebrating this killing of Bin Laden like they just won a big Super Bowl game and putting their finger up there. One, we're number one, we're number one. USA, yeah, we got him, we killed him. What a disgusting display of false consciousness, just being led around by the nose and knee-jerked around by your leaders and the mass media.
What bothered me, Michael, is these were mostly young people out in the middle of the night. All the people were home in bed sleeping, like sane people would do. And of course, they were at Ground Zero. They were in Times Square. And it bothered me so much to see these reveling young people, making me wonder, is this what the youth of America today are all about? My God, I mean, we'll never get any change if these people literally go out celebrating a crime they should be denouncing, the idea that America can rampage into another country, and I honestly don't know who they killed, but they certainly killed people in another country, didn't even inform the Pakistanis that they were coming in, and we just sent in we sent in the Marines, in this case we sent in the Navy SEALs, but commandos, thugs, hired killers, and they came in guns blazing, and they just shot up the place and killed people who apparently were unarmed after the original story saying they engaged in a fierce firefight, and then they changed their mind, and then they changed their mind again, and then they changed their mind again. But the final story was, we went in unopposed, but we went in guns blazing and shot the place to pieces and killed people in there. So we killed.
Well, no, they said that Bin Laden had resisted. He was unarmed. They finally admitted he was unarmed when they dropped the AK-47 story and said he was unarmed, but he resisted. And the question was raised, one moment of truth on BBC, I heard a little bit, which went along with the whole mythology, but otherwise one announcer said, but the question is, how could he resist if he was unarmed? If you have these guys rushing in, armed to the teeth, how do you resist exactly if you're unarmed? You pick up a tablespoon, or you grab a chair, or you just make a fist, or what? It was just poppycock. It was just pure baloney. And anybody who keeps changing their story, you can be sure they're lying. When people keep changing their story, that means they're not telling the truth. And that's what we got from the White House today. And you'll see him playing this and milking it and giving them medals and making little speeches and standing there and making his little salutes and playing at gee, I'm the president stuff. Just grandstanding crap. That's all we're getting from this White House, instead of what we need, which is a rational economic program for jobs and betterment and building up our infrastructure and cutting back on the immense military spending and taxing the super rich who don't even pay their share of taxes, and taxing the corporations. You pay more income tax this year than General Electric or Exxon.
Oh, for sure, absolutely. I mean, they
congratulate you.
Michael, that's why the music means we're coming to the end of the hour. That's why your newest book, all your books are important. My God, I've read almost all of them. They're treasures on my shelf.
Can I ask people also to go to my website, michaelparenti.org, and they can see the new book. The new book is The Face of Imperialism.
The title says it all. What's going on, what this country rots around the world, including at home, Michael, is the face of imperialism. It's a shocking, disgusting story that people need to understand and decide if they're not going to do something about it to change. This will be the dire future that they will face. And if they finally awaken to just how bad it is, it may be too late to do anything about it. They should start by going out and reading your book. Michael, my great thanks to you for coming on. We got a little late start. We had a rain delay, but it was a wonderful most of the hour. We only missed a short bit. It was a wonderful program. I look forward to doing. Are you working on another book now?
I'll let you know about that some other time. Okay.
I hope so. Michael, thank you so much.
Right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And join us, of course, every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for programs like this one with Michael Parenti talking about the most important things we need to know in our own self-defense. And if we don't do it, nobody will do it for us. Join us often.